KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Zadie Smith is a British novelist, essayist, and short story writer. Her most recent novel, NW, takes its name from the postal code of Northwest London. It's her first in 7 years. The New York Times recently called NW one of the 10 best books of the year. Zadie Smith joins us from the NPR studios in New York City, where she's a tenured professor at the Creative Writing Program at New York University. Zadie Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about Northwest London. What's it like compared to the London that many visitors to London see?
Well, it depends what kind of visitor you are. If you can't quite afford the hotels in the middle of town, you might see a bit of North London. Mm-hmm. You have to stretch out a bit to the boundaries. I would say it's like the rest of the city in that it's very mixed, obviously, but it's a kind of strange mixture of suburban. It's really an urban suburb. It looks like a kind of 19th century suburb, but it's filled with immigrants from all over the world in waves, basically, from the Jewish people who came in the 20s to the Bengalis, Indians, Pakistanis, Africans, Caribbeans, Irish. It's a real mix.
What was it like for you to grow up there?
A lot of fun, actually. It was really engaging. I come from a mixed family anyway. I'm one of the products of the fruition of the Jamaicans and the Irish, which happened in the 70s. A lot of Jamaicans married Irish or English, and I'm one of those. So it was nice. I never felt like an anomaly. I was one of a big crowd.
There's a conventional narrative of people who rise from poverty to privilege of glowing success, but part of what you deal with in NW are the kind of pressures that apply even when you have gotten to a place that you want to be. That was one of the themes I was picking up about. Is that part of what you were trying to convey?
Yeah, I guess I was thinking, you know, one of the things that you're always told to aspire to is this sense of exclusivity, right? Like the higher up you go, the more you are, you have things to yourself, your own car, your own house. If you get to the extreme end, your own plane, your own island. And it just struck me how isolating that fantasy is, you know. And one of the things we kind of dismiss or think is a hard life is living communally. I grew up in what you would call a project. I would call a council estate. And to me, there's something interesting about living on a corridor with a lot of people living in that communal way. It's not all good, obviously. It can be tough times, but it's not all bad either. And this constant aspiration to absolute isolation, I just was interested in it as an idea.
Zadie Smith is my guest. Her most recent novel is NW. She's at NPR in New York City, where she now lives part of the time during the year. Is it difficult to maintain the concentration a writer needs in a city with so many distractions?
You know, I've never been a pastoral writer. I've always been working in very noisy streets around lots of noisy people. So it suits me fine. I mean, I have some habits. I need to work sounds a bit depressing, but in a room, you know, where my desk faces the wall. I can't be doing with a view of a lively street. I like to just focus on what I'm doing. But then there are cultural distractions, but they're all good. You know, I love one of the few things you get as a writer is the opportunity to go out any time in the day and go to a museum or go to see a movie, and New York's the perfect place for that.
Northwest London is like a character. It's a big part of the novel NW. Has New York City found its way into your fiction, or will it, do you think?
It wasn't meant to. I was planning a kind of science fiction novel, actually, and had big, extensive plans, and then this little novella about the neighborhood I'm in, the West Village, came into my mind. So that is what I'm doing at the moment. So it forced its way in. I like neighborhoods one way or another, and the village is a great one.
You talked about the communality of where you lived in Northwest London as part of what you were capturing in that novel. Is there something about the West Village, some characteristic of it, that is weaving its way into this novella you're working on?
I think so. I mean, it's historical. It's set in the kind of late 60s, early 70s. I guess what struck me, I mean, the people who survived from that period who you meet around the place is their kind of commitment to whatever they were doing, even if it was extremely minor or strange, if they had a habit of painting 2x4-inch paintings or running a puppet show or doing some tiny little cultural event. To them, during that period, it was the center of everything, and I kind of like that quirky commitment to small matters that I found in the village. So it's kind of a comic novel about that.
You teach in the creative writing program at New York University. Mm-hmm. Are there overarching themes you try to convey to your students about writing fiction?
Yeah, I think the main thing is to kind of beat a certain kind of romanticism out of them. I don't mean that in a bad way, but I want them to concentrate on things like reading, practical things. When students turn up in my class, they're very focused on words like creativity, which I think is a very American idea that there's this kind of amorphous spirit called creativity, and they think that writers have it or that artists have it, and it's like a magic formula. And that's not my experience of writing. My experience of writing is much more practical, that it comes out of an affection and interest in other people's artworks, in looking at things, reading things, studying things. So my creative writing class is really all about the sweat and not so much about the inspiration. It's just about getting them to read as many things as possible in as varied a way as possible.
Have you had the satisfaction, Zadie Smith, of seeing that influence you're trying to impress upon them have an effect over the course of a school year?
A little, but I haven't. I've had friends like the writer Nathan Englander, who seems to, every other year, a student of his publishes a fantastic novel. I don't seem to have been so lucky. I'm kind of in competition with Nathan, and I'm losing. Oh. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I create more critics than fiction writers. That might be true. I noticed quite a few of my students end up on the New York Review or the New Yorker, so maybe that's what happens.
Do you learn anything from your students about writing?
Yes, an enormous amount. Whenever you feel particularly down or cynical or tired about it, it's so great to be in front of, 14, 18-year-old kids who have never read Kafka or have never read Nabokov, have never read anything, really. And their enthusiasm for just simple storytelling, every year, it's fantastic for me.
You also are an accomplished essayist, and you wrote an essay titled Joy for the New York Review of Books. And in it, you write, "If you asked me if I wanted more joyful experiences in my life, I wouldn't be at all sure I did," end quote. Why is that?
Well, I guess I was trying to describe the difference between a pleasure and a joy. The pleasures are, fairly obvious and easy to come by, and you can buy them and eat them and go on holiday in them and all the rest of it. But a joy seemed to me a little more of a complex thing. To me, anyway, it's my own theory that when you feel a lot of joy, it's usually about things which are also filled with the possibility of loss. Now, like children, with the example I was trying to give, you feel this extreme joy around your children, but it's always tinged with this terror of the possibility of anything happening to them or them being lost to you. And it seems to me joy is one of those emotions. It's quite extreme. And, you wouldn't want to feel that for too many people. You'd hardly be able to wake up in the morning, though. It's best limited to a small crowd.
You sum it up 5 or 6 times when you truly felt joyful in your life. And when you sat down to write this, did they immediately come to mind, or did it take some reaching back and considering to come up with those experiences?
No, actually, they did immediately come to mind. And I have a feeling, this is just a theory, that if you ask most people, it would come to them very quickly. It's something you don't forget, that sensation. And I think I was trying to say it can drive you crazy, because you can spend the rest of your life trying to have that feeling again. And actually, it's quite rare. But no, they came really quickly, and it was very nice to recall them, actually, all at once.
You mentioned the joy of having a child, and there's a line in the essay, "The child, too, is a pleasure, though mostly she is a joy," which means, in fact, she gives us not much pleasure at all. what's that mean?
I guess I was talking recently on stage, actually, with the comic book artist Chris Ware, who also has a kid and is a very great comic book artist. He says something which made me laugh, which is a common experience, I think, of people who have children. You spend all day, if you're away from them, working, missing them, desperate to see them, and you rush home, and then the moment you see them after 5 minutes, you're like, oh my God, this is a nightmare. They're driving me crazy. So there's some kind of ideal form they have in your mind, and you do adore them and you love them, but on the practical day-to-day matter of having children, they are deeply annoying a lot of the time. And it's just a strange thing having to accommodate in your mind the idea of something which is in fact very joyous that doesn't actually bring you that much pleasure. It's not the same as going out wild partying or going to see a great movie. It's full of tension and anxiety and tedium, but it still has this aspect of joy.
Joy and pleasure are all part of happiness, a much studied topic these days. Scientists trying to figure out what is this happiness and how can one achieve it? And I was very interested to see in your essay called Joy reflected some of the stuff that I've been reading from many researchers in this area, the idea that some of the simplest things in life can really give you an enormous amount of pleasure and hence happiness. You write about the popsicle you wait for all day long.
Yeah. I mean, that is the case with me. I like food, so it doesn't have to be very fancy. I like simple food. But I do think that's true about happiness. Sometimes you have an idea, particularly in this culture and my culture too, in England, that happiness can just be got at by adding more and more and more, you know, but getting to a kind of more extreme state of accumulation. And that doesn't seem to work for a lot of people. Instead, it creates this kind of anxiety. So I guess I was looking for simple ways. But the other thing about happiness and joy, it seems to me, is that part of it, part of the experience is like ego defeating. For some reason, if you're fully present as an ego, it's hard to feel happiness because you're so self-conscious or anxious. I always find happiness comes at the point where you are self-forgetful in one way or another. And maybe that's another way in which loving somebody or caring for something else, that works.
There's this strain of thought about happiness that we're very bad at figuring out what will make us happy, that thing we think will make us happy, that job, that fellowship, that vacation. When it actually happens, it's never quite what we had expected it to be. Do you find it that way with joy? The thing we think will make you joyous never doesn't really quite get there?
Yeah, we're almost always mistaken, particularly about holidays. No, that's the one failure every year, particularly for the American and English, for some reason. Whenever I see my fellow Brits or my cousin Americans abroad, I see us all in terrible pain, actually. It's going really badly. We feel awkward. We don't speak the language. We're not at home. We're wondering why we came and why we spent so much money. I think sometimes settling into what suits you rather than what you're told suits you. Like in my case, I'm a terrible tourist. I hate to travel, but I quite like going somewhere and living there for 6 months. That works for me. And making everything exactly the same as it was at home. That's perfect for me. But traveling from island to island doesn't suit me, no matter how many times an advert tells me it's paradise on earth. So I think you have to find your own definition, though.
In the latest New Yorker, you wrote an essay about Joni Mitchell, a musician you never cared for until suddenly you did. But you kind of freight that very simple observation with a lot of other things about art. And what are some of the things you were trying to convey in your reflections about your relationship to the artist Joni Mitchell?
Really, it was just I was reflecting on my own stupidity about music. You know, I have no important opinions about music, and I don't really understand it very well. And after a while, when you feel that way about an art form, you get a little scared of it, and you get nervous. You kind of stick to the things you know well, and you don't venture outwards. And it made me feel a bit melancholy that I got to that point with music. Something I used to love as a child, kind of innocently or happily, and you can become anxious and then self-defensive. And so I thought about that instinct in me, and then I kind of wondered if other people felt it too, and for other art forms in different forms, and what a shame it is, because actually you don't have to be intellectually ready for art. You know, you just need to be open to it, and I really admire people who have the ability to be wide open in front of something new, something sometimes scary or something they don't quite comprehend. I don't often have it, so when I see it in other people, I see it quite a lot in my students actually. I find it interesting, like a quality I would like to have more of. So it was really an essay about that.
And we're much more open to that, I think, when we're in our late teens and 20s, particularly when it comes to music. We're open to absorbing all of it and sampling it and not feeling as though, oh, I'm too old to try something new. But there is a moment you describe in the essay where all of a sudden this musician who you have an interesting way of describing her voice, it's ill effects on you, and then that changed. Can you describe that moment?
I think in the face of someone like Joni Mitchell, whose brilliance is so unavoidably obvious, sooner or later I had to give in. But I think it was my ideas about her were very set, you know, and I tried to describe them that they were partly cultural. I grew up around black music almost exclusively, with a little variant into what you would call, I suppose, white music, my father's music. But I was used to a certain kind of tone and rhythm. You get very set in your mind of what good music is and even what a good voice is. So listening to Mitchell's voice was just news to me. You know, it was a different way of thinking about singing. And it came to me a bit late in life, so it was kind of a shock. But once you stop worrying about those categories and allow yourself just to listen properly, then this great wave of beauty comes over you. And I was so grateful that that happened. It doesn't happen very often. As you get older, I think it gets harder and harder to really look at things afresh without your preconceptions of one kind or another.
It's interesting how different cities can turn you on to music, too. I'm thinking particularly of New Orleans, a city I've visited numerous times, and you just can't avoid music in New Orleans. It suffuses the place. And I'm wondering if New York at all has gotten you to listen to new music. Or other places. Well,
I think the journey thing must be that, right? It must be some influence of the village, some historical village seeping into my mind. It has, just because for the first time in my life, I live in something like the center of town. You know, I've always lived on the edges of the center of town in these urban suburbs one way or another. Now I can just walk out my door and go and hear music. And it's not a 45-minute cab ride, and it's an easy thing. So I do listen to it a bit more, and also my students, again, force me to join the contemporary world every now and then musically, which is great. I'm still stuck on the things I've always been stuck on, but it's nice to have little openings.
Do you fraternize with your students? How do you hang out with them?
No, I don't. I'm afraid I don't. I don't do that at all. And mainly because the way I was educated, I mean, I didn't even call my professor by his first name. I didn't know it until I left university. So it's just a completely unfamiliar relationship to me. I wouldn't know how to begin doing that. I think sometimes I disappoint them in that area. But I teach and then that's it. Yeah.
Zadie Smith, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Novelist, essayist, and short story writer Zadie Smith. Her most recent novel, NW, it takes its name from the postal code of Northwest London. It was called by the New York Times recently one of the 10 best books of the year. And speaking of Joni Mitchell, you can't let the holiday season go by without playing this.
Reindeer and singing songs of joy and peace. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. I'm gonna make a lot of money, then I'm gonna quit this crazy scene. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I had a river so long, I would teach my feet to fly. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby cry.
Joni Mitchell, River, from the Blue Album. David Hyde produces the conversation with Arwen Nix. We get production help from Cameron Drews. Andy Hurst is our engineer. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.